And this is Occupied Territory with Mike Fader. This is a program that's on every week, Thursdays, live from 1 to 2 p.m. Eastern Time. And, of course, it's available later on podcast, which is devoted. This program is devoted to the issues raised by the Occupy movement. Now, everybody knows who's listening in any different state in this country. The states are under a barrage, right? They're laying off teachers. Corporations have run wild. They're polluting states all over the place with fracking. Businesses are out of control. Legislatures are out of control. They're cutting union jobs off. People are really hurting in every state in the union in every way due to greed and, you know, government corruption, control by corporations of the government. But there is one state maybe that's hurting worse than all the other states, and not to make a competition out of it, but West Virginia is in really, really bad shape and has been for quite a while and is at this moment in every possible way. And we're going to talk to a guest today who knows about the situation, specifically about coal mining, but and mountaintop clearance, or mountaintop removal in West Virginia. But specifically what it does to every aspect of people's lives down there and to the land itself. And we have with us Bob Kincaid. Hi, Bob.
Hey, Mike. Thanks for taking time to chat with me today.
Oh, absolutely. Let me read you listeners some stuff about Bob, and then Bob and I will have a conversation here. Bob Kincaid is a nationally recognized broadcaster and human rights activist. And maybe you could give yourself a plug for when your show is and what the show is.
Oh, sure. I host a show called Head On with Bob Kincaid. It airs 6 to 9 p.m. Eastern Time, Monday through Friday, at headonradionetwork.com, iTunes Radio, Tuner Internet Radio, those sorts of platforms.
Okay, and is it preserved? The broadcasts are on podcast later on?
It's podcasted at iTunes as well as at whiterosesociety.org.
Okay, give it again, the time and the day that it's on.
6 to 9 p.m. Monday through Friday.
Okay. And he's says here, I'm reading from the bio you sent me. He's an 8th-generation hillbilly. And go ahead, yeah.
Well, yeah, I really am. The 8th or 10th, it all depends on which line of the family you go down, but... Okay. We've been here in these hills and hollers for a while.
All right. So not only your own, obviously your own experience, but everything in your family to add into it and everybody you know. He and his wife are trying to raise a family in Fayette County, West Virginia, amid the myriad poisons pumped into his community and region by the remorseless corporate predators of the mountaintop removal coal industry. He is president of the board of Coal River Mountain Watch, a grassroots organization leading the struggle against mountaintop removal in the very heart of Big Coal's Appalachian Sacrifice Zone. And the website for that is crmw.net, crmw.net. Bob is also a founding member of the Appalachian Community Health Emergency, that's ACHE, Appalachian Community Health Emergency Campaign, seeking to bring an immediate end to the coal-created health disaster unfolding among innocent victims who live in the hills and hollers of Appalachia. And that is stoptheache.org, stoptheache.org. Now, if you want to get more information about this, it will be on the Facebook page later on. All this information will be on the Facebook page displayed there, and you can access this information. The Facebook page, just Google Occupied Territory and Facebook, Occupied Territory and Facebook. So I mentioned to you when we were corresponding a week or so ago that I had read a chapter of a book that's going to come out in June, written by Chris Hedges and illustrated by someone named Joe Sacco, which specifically was about, this chapter was about what goes on in West Virginia. And it's, for people who don't know from the outside, it's staggering, it's shocking, and it just makes you sick to your stomach and sick in your soul what companies have done. Not just to the land itself, but because that's where it starts, but how it affects the whole culture down there. And I don't know where to start with this, but maybe you do.
It is, Mike, something that it's pervasive, I guess, is the word we're probably both looking for. It is based in the land, but it affects the land itself. It affects the water. It affects the air we breathe. There are places in West Virginia where the ground is now so poisoned with chemicals from mountaintop removal that scientists are telling people not to eat food grown in their garden. It's stunning. There is a body of science, peer-reviewed science data that has emerged over the last couple of years that is showing that this is not merely, and merely is probably a bad word, but this is not
just
a so-called environmental concern, that it is really, really a human rights crisis here. For instance, between 1996 and 2003, there's a study that surveyed 1.8 million births in Appalachia during that time period. And what they found is that birth defect rates in mountaintop removal communities are vastly disproportionate to anything you would expect to see, and certainly off the charts as regards the general population. Just one little statistic. Let's compare two pregnant mothers. One of them lives in a community that doesn't have mountaintop removal. Mm-hmm. And the other one lives in a community that does. The one that lives in the community that has mountaintop removal is being a really good mommy to be. She doesn't smoke, she's taking care of herself, all of that. Well, she has a 181% greater chance of giving birth to a baby with respiratory birth defects than the mommy in the mountaintop, in the non-mountaintop removal community, who smokes like a chimney.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
That's shocking to the conscience when you think about it. But it's everything. It's cancer, it's respiratory disease, cardiac disease. We are literally being killed for profit. Because let's understand one very basic thing about mountaintop removal, Mike, and that is this. It is not necessary.
And well, that's what I was going to ask. Maybe what we could do is just, since a lot of people may not know that. Obviously, people know West Virginia is famous for coal mining, but mountaintop removal has been around for how long, and exactly what is it? What's the process?
Well, it began in its earliest form in the 1970s. There's currently some litigation about the very first mountaintop removal job. And it's a toxic waste zone. All mountaintop removal sites are toxic waste sites. The West Virginia Department of Environmental Protection once admitted in open court that if they shut down mines for water toxicity violations, they wouldn't be able to allow mountaintop removal to exist. Mountaintop removal is a process whereby vast amounts of the same high explosives that Timothy McVeigh used on the Murrah Federal Building in Oklahoma City are used on our mountains. Somewhere between 3 and 5 million pounds of ammonium nitrate and fuel oil explosives are used in West Virginia every day. Okay, and I know your listeners are probably and have been probably shocked and horrified over the last decade at what we did to Iraq and Afghanistan.
Mm.
Now, imagine this. We corporate predators are allowed to use more high explosives on my home than have been used combined in Iraq and Afghanistan. Maybe that'll give somebody an idea. They drill holes into the mountain, they blow the mountain up, they push all the detritus over into the valley and kill every living thing that moves, breathes, walks, crawls, flies. They bury streams. They get to the coal seam. The coal seam may be 10, 12 inches thick, but it's acres broad, and they scrape it all up, and then they blow up some more, and they scrape out another layer. And it goes, if you look at it, for instance, on Google Earth, it looks like Appalachia is pocked with cancer. Vast moonscapes.
And so when they're done raping the mountain, then they just move on off to someplace else, right?
Right. Technically, under the law, which is pathetically enforced, if it is enforced at all, they're told to reclaim what they did. Well, they don't. Less than 3% of all mountaintop removal sites in Appalachia, and that includes West Virginia, Eastern Kentucky, Southwestern Virginia, and East Tennessee, less than 3% of all mountaintop removal sites have ever been reclaimed within the meaning of the law.
What companies are we talking about here?
We're talking about Alpha, which used to be Massey. Alpha absorbed.
Oh, they changed
Massey
their name, real.
Right. But Alpha was another company. They bought Massey out after Massey had the disaster underground with the Upper Big Branch a couple of years ago about this time. So you've got Alpha / Massey. You've got Arch. You've got Consol. You've got Peabody. You've got Oh, God. Well, here in my county, and this is one of those shocking things that we don't think about. Here in my county, there's a mountain being blown up, and I live in a tourism area. I live within a mile of the national park.
Mm-hmm.
So there's whitewater rafting and hiking and climbing and biking. It's beautiful. Well, within 3 miles of that, a company called Fraser Creek Mining is blowing up a mountain right next to a public water supply. And they are owned by a company from Mumbai, India called SR, ESSAR,
mm-hmm.
which is controlled by, I guess, India's answer to the Koch brothers. Their names are Shashi and Ravi Ruia.
Mm-hmm.
And they don't care what they do here. They're going to make their filthy mess. And every scrap of coal that comes out of that mountain is getting on a boat and going to India.
Where is most of the coal that's extracted from blowing up these mountains? Where is it shipped to? I mean, who uses it?
Well, a lot of it goes overseas. A vast amount of it goes to China. A great deal of it also goes to India. Some of it goes to Russia. We've had a Russian conglomerate buy out a bunch of mines in West Virginia as well. Some of it is used in electric power generation plants, but we need to be very, very clear on this, Mike.
Mm.
Coal accounts for less than 40% of the electricity used in the United States today. Of that 40%, mountaintop removal accounts for less than 5%.
Really?
In other words, we could end it tomorrow and nobody's lights would even dim, let alone go out. But the coal industry has a profoundly well-financed PR filth machine, if I may say so.
Say what you like.
Yeah, and they're constantly... for instance, around here there is a coal cult in this region, where people say things like, "Well, you tree huggers just want us to freeze to death in the dark."
So these
can end mountaintop removal, and nobody's going to even get chilly.
So the people who say these kinds of things, who are these people? Why don't they understand? And what is the problem?
Well, I forget who the great thinker was. I always confuse Upton Sinclair and Sinclair Lewis.
Mm-hmm.
But one of those two said, "It is hard to get a man to understand something when his paycheck depends on him not understanding it."
I think that might have been Upton Sinclair when he was talking about the meatpacking industry. You know,
I think you're probably right.
Yeah. Well, there you go. That's the reason why
And add into this the fact that the entire political structure of the state of West Virginia is a wholly owned subsidiary of the coal industry. Okay.
Democrat
and Republican mean nothing here.
Well, they don't mean anything anywhere now, but they specifically obviously don't mean anything there. Who are your representatives and your senators there, so we know who we're talking about here? I want to establish a kind of a name rogues gallery so people know what's going on.
Okay, well, my congressman is Nick Joe Rahal, and he's been a member of the House of Representatives since Christ was a corporal in the Army of God.
I mean,
like 36, 38 years. He claims personal responsibility for stopping a bill when the Democrats still had control of Congress that would have severely limited mountaintop removal. It wouldn't have ended it. It's called the Clean Water Protection Act. It wouldn't have ended it, but it would have severely curtailed it.
And he lives in West Virginia?
He claims personal responsibility for stopping it.
And he lives in West Virginia?
He's from the Beckley, West Virginia area, about 35 miles from where I live.
Uh-huh. And what senators are we talking about here?
Well, my senators are Jay Rockefeller.
Oh. Mm-hmm.
Who heads the science committee in the Senate, and yet that birth defect statistic that I gave you a few minutes ago, Mike.
Yeah.
He won't even acknowledge that the study exists. I'm not kidding. He won't even admit that it exists. He won't use his power on the science committee to even so much as have the scientists come in and explain their findings. And then, of course, my other senator is Joe Manchin, who folks might remember is famous for having run a campaign ad in which he bravely and heroically shot the cap and trade bill while it was tied to a tree. I'm not kidding.
And so, obviously, we take it for granted that a majority of their donations, all of these politicians' donations, and probably the state legislature, too, come from the coal industry, right?
Oh, absolutely. I wasn't kidding when I said they are a wholly owned subsidiary.
You mentioned before
that Nick Rahal has jumped out of a plane for coal. I'm not kidding.
Jumped out of a plane? But he, maybe he could do it again. And well, let's not get into the speculation.
No, he parachuted into the Friends of Coal Auto Show a couple of years back.
Yeah, he parachuted
as a show of devotion, I guess.
I'm sorry. Let me move on a little bit. You mentioned before a mythical organization called the Department of Environmental Protection. West Virginia.
Well, here in West Virginia, we call them the Department of Environmental Permitting.
So
they're a rubber stamp agency.
Now, this is a common thing with states all over the place. I mean, it happens everywhere, especially now. New York State is concerned, too, as is Pennsylvania with its Marcellus Shale thing. And
oh, sure.
It's well known that in almost every state, there are very few departments of environmental protection that are protecting the people at all, quite the opposite. Mm-hmm. But you've got a real case down there, right?
This is better than when the clowns come out at the circus.
Mm-hmm.
I've inquired of DEP officials what it would take for them to deny a mountain top removal permit, and I've asked them things like, "What if they found gold on the mountain?"
Mm-hmm.
No, we wouldn't stop them. What if you found a vast Indian burial ground? Nope, we wouldn't stop them. Nothing.
So I presume
mountaintop removal operation.
Who's your governor down there?
He's presently an old hand political fixer of some three decades, Earl Ray Tomlin.
Mm. Okay, but when the Department of Environmental Protection, presumably they have some scientists attached to them, or some of them are scientists, right?
Yes.
Now, essentially, what we're dealing with here is murder, right? These corporations are murdering people. So you would almost consider the environmental protection people, whose job is to literally to protect people, specifically, scientifically, and health-wise, to protect the people of West Virginia, they are accomplices to murder.
They are accessories before the fact, without a doubt, and after the fact.
So I'm glad you
brought that up, Mike, because this is another one of the studies that's so very important. We've actually found out recently that we hillbillies here have become the currency. I know it sounds crazy, but it's true.
Wait, your signal's breaking up just a little bit. Are you on the move, or it's just
that's... No, I'm not moving at all.
Okay, that happens. Yeah,
sometimes. Technology, what a marvel.
That's another whole show. Go ahead.
Yeah, what I said is we've become a unit of currency. There are less than 4,000 mountaintop removers, you know, people who work on mountaintop removal. There are less than 4,000 of those in the state of West Virginia.
Mm-hmm.
It turns out that it costs 3,795 hillbilly lives per year for mountaintop removal to go on. So basically, we are a unit. You know, we're a unit of currency. We are what we are what gets paid in order for mountaintop removers to say they have a job.
One
dead hillbilly supports one mountaintop remover every year.
Presumably, the people who are working on mountaintop removal are the one who are accusing other people of being tree huggers and liberal communists and everything else, right? I mean, they don't really know any better. But you know, a job is a job, right? And food is food, and rent is rent. In your state, there must be a hell of a lot of people who are unemployed, way beyond the national average. And I've also been reading that there's a lot of, with all the health problems, with all the unemployment, there's a huge problem with drug addiction down there, too, right? Prescription drugs, too?
Oh, sure. And health problems out the gazoo, and no access to health care. It is of epidemic proportions. That's why I founded this Appalachian Community Health Emergency Group, was to start talking about mountaintop removal in all of these terms, where it impacts human health and the ability to go on being a person from day to day. You know, the ability of 4-year-olds to turn into 5-year-olds.
If you just tuned in, we're listening to Bob Kincaid, who is a broadcaster down in West Virginia, and his show, like every show now, can be heard anywhere, anytime. And why don't you give the station and information and the show information again?
Thank you, Mike. It's headonradionetwork.com. My show's Head On with Bob Kincaid. It airs Monday through Friday at 6 to 9 p.m. Eastern time. Yeah, you can get it through things like Stitcher Radio, iTunes, that sort of thing.
We are having trouble with the signal, but that's how it goes with these things. But we'll continue on anyhow. Now, having laid all this out and the horrible situation that's going on down there and the collusion of the government officials so that no one is protecting you, what is the role and what is the state of the unions down there?
It grieves me to say this because my father, my grandfather, and my great-grandfather were all active in the United Mine Workers of America.
Mm-hmm.
Okay? So, I mean, I come from a proud heritage. But the United Mine Workers of America are dead to me.
Mm-hmm.
They are a part of the problem, not a part of the solution. The reason I say that is that they accepted mountaintop removal workers into their ranks. And even though mountaintop removal destroys underground mining jobs, it's undeniable. When mountaintop removal slows down, you get more underground mining jobs. We've seen it happen over the last couple of years. They actively advocate for more. And one of the chief critics and fear-mongers of the EPA, this ongoing assault against the Environmental Protection Agency at the federal level, has been UMWA President Cecil Roberts.
So he's basically sold out.
Lock, stock, and barrel.
So here you are. You don't have the government protecting you, specifically even the agency that's supposed to protect you. The law doesn't protect you. The legislature doesn't protect you. The unions don't protect you. So what do you think people can do or should do to protect themselves?
They can do what we're doing with the AIC program, the AIC campaign.
Mm-hmm.
We are armed with facts, not speculation, not imagining, not fear mongering. We're armed with scientific, peer reviewed facts, and we are going on a regular basis to Washington, D.C., and we are actively calling for a moratorium on all mountaintop removal permits until a fully funded federal study can be accomplished over a period of years to isolate and identify exactly what parts of this process are causing the cancer, are causing the heart disease, the lung disease, are causing the birth defects. But it's got to happen in Washington, and it's got to happen with people outside West Virginia calling their congresspeople, because as we've noted in this conversation, mm-hmm. it is not going to happen by the as a result of anything done by the wholly owned subsidiary politicians of coal here in Appalachia. I think we can stop it. I think there is enough of a conscience in this country that we can demand that it be ended.
I think people
can bring pressure to bear on their elected representatives outside Appalachia to step in and stop this. Because after all, Mike, and this is very important, if a foreign power was doing to Appalachia what coal companies are doing to Appalachia, and many of them are, in fact, foreign powers, we would be at war with them.
Well, speaking of being at war, let me read you a little bit. It's like a paragraph and a half from this upcoming book. It says here, and you can explain more about this after I'm done here. We're talking about a place called Blair Mountain. And it says here, Blair was the site of the largest civil uprising and armed insurgency in the United States since the Civil War. In late August and early September 1921, as many as 15,000 armed miners, angered by a series of assassinations of union leaders and their chief supporters, as well as mass evictions, blacklists, and wholesale firings by coal companies, for 5 days faced militias and police who were equipped with heavy machine guns and held back advancing miners from behind the trench system still visible on the ridge that we're looking at. And it goes on to talk more about this. And there was also a film that was made once, I think, called Matewan.
Matewan.
Can you talk about a little bit about Blair Mountain? I'm bringing this up now because, you know, this show is dedicated to issues that have been raised by the Occupy movement. And certainly almost everything that has to do with corporate greed fits into that. And West Virginia is ground zero there. And the Occupy movement was always talking about nonviolent action. And so far what you've mentioned is, you know, organizing around getting the federal government to do things. This country, now I'm not suggesting anything, and your response is your response, but this country was born in an armed revolution. And sometimes it took armed struggle in this country to form unions and to that we fought a civil war over certain issues. I'm just mentioning this. So whatever your response is, it is.
And I understand your point, Mike. But let me point out something about the Battle of Blair Mountain. One, it is historically significant, and we know that it's historically significant primarily by virtue of the fact that that the corporate textbooks do everything in their power not to teach it to our children.
Yeah, you know, I never heard of it before, and I studied a lot of history in school. That's interesting.
Billy Mitchell, was the general who developed the theory of air power in the early 20th century, put his first theories of air power to the test by bombing American citizens at Blair Mountain. Okay. But let's understand this about the Battle of Blair Mountain. The people who took up arms against the coal company and, by extension, against the government, because the coal company controlled the government, lost. And they didn't just, it wasn't even close. They lost big. The nascent union movement in West Virginia was crushed like a bug for a decade and a half. And agitation didn't bring it back. And violence didn't bring it back. Workers' rights only came into being with the passage of the National Labor Relations Act in, I believe, 1935 in the Franklin Delano Roosevelt administration.
Right.
I am wholeheartedly committed to nonviolence because the other side has all the money and that money will always buy more guns. And, you know, they're willing to kill 4,000 of us a year just for their profits. If we threaten them with violence, they'll kill twice as many. They really don't care.
Since they're doing this to people, can you not get the Justice Department interested in doing something about it on a federal level?
Well, the Justice Department has its representative in the form of the United States Attorney for the Southern District of West Virginia, but there's that Southern District of West Virginia problem. Again, no, they're not going to rock that boat absent profound proof. We're all kind of watching and waiting the outcome of the upper Big Branch disaster investigation, and there have been a couple of sort of mid-level patsies indicted so far, and we're waiting to see if this U.S. attorney is going to have the starch to go after the person who really ought to be indicted for murder, and that is, of course, Don Blankenship.
Who showed up as one of the great organizers of the Tea Party rally in Washington, representing American workers.
Don't get me started.
Yeah, I know.
He's a psychopath. He's a madman.
Well, you know, maybe it's a little heartening that you noticed, as I'm sure as I did the other day, that they indicted a middle-level man, the Justice Department, in the BP disaster, and they claim that higher-level people are to come to be indicted. We're just about at the end of the time we have here, but if you wanted to sum up somehow and get people involved again, and like I say, I'm going to post the information about where people can go to get involved or to help or to donate on our website, but why don't you mention all the information again?
Absolutely. StopTheAche.org, A-C-H-E, StopTheAche.org. There's a PayPal button there. We need all the help we can get because it costs money to get hillbillies out of Appalachia into Washington, D.C. to do work and to go around and tell people what is going on here. This health crisis is the thing that can finally call America's conscience so thoroughly into the forefront that we will end this torment. CRMW.net is the homepage of the organization with which I work. You can sign up for the newsletter there. You can buy probably one of the coolest T-shirts in America, the Save the Endangered Hillbilly T-shirt. Everybody will ask you about it when they see you wearing it. And more than anything else, you can also at the CRMW.net website read all of these health studies and summaries of all these health studies and get your mind around exactly. I mean, this is slow rolling genocide going on here, Mike.
Mm-hmm.
And only with personal awareness, at the very basic level, will we be informed enough to go forward and demand that people that this be ended by people who have to respond to us.
All right. Bob Kincaid, thank you very much. To stay where you are and to keep fighting like that, I guess you're not leaving because your family's been there forever and your family is there now. You're not evacuating. You're not running away. But it's a tough fight.
We're a bunch of cranky Scots. We're a bunch of cranky Scots Irish, and we don't run.
Okay, Bob Kincaid, thank you very much for coming on.
Thank you, Mike. Have a great day.
Yeah, you too. All right, this is Mike Fader here. The show is Occupied Territory. Any interviews you hear on here will be posted as podcasts, and you can listen to them in the archives of this show by going to prn.fm, just checking Occupied Territory, and you'll see our archives of the shows. Also, we will post this information on our Facebook page, Occupied Territory on Facebook. We're going to take a short break now, and we're going to come back with another guest who is also taking some action. Okay, this is Mike Fader, and we're back here on Occupied Territory trying to get in touch with our second guest. Whether or not we do, who knows? There are new phones out every single day that can do a million things, except apparently actually receive and send phone calls. Modern technology really is wonderful. We have with us Elliot Adams, who's the former president of Veterans for Peace. Elliot Adams and two other members of Veterans for Peace, Russell Brown, John, and John Abaddon, were among 33 peaceful protesters arrested on Sunday outside Hancock Airfield Base in New York State. And almost all of the 33 were arrested preemptively. Remember, we once had rights in this country? Preemptively, before they did anything, as they walked single file and silently along a road prior to reaching the military base at which they intended to approach the gate and deliver a written statement. They are all part of something called the Upstate Coalition to ground the drones. This is a drone training base. They reported that the Onondaga County Sheriff's Department in New York State made the arrests in Mattydale, New York, two blocks from the entrance to the base. So before they violated the law, they got arrested. This is how it is now, Americans or former Americans. I don't know what country we live in anymore. If you break the law, you could get arrested. Everybody was brought up to understand that. Now, apparently, if you're talking about breaking the law or thinking about breaking the law, or even if you look like you might break the law, you can get arrested, which is breaking the basic law. To do that is breaking the basic law of America. But what do they care anymore? Those arrested included an 87-year-old woman in a wheelchair, parents accompanying their children, a member of the press. And it's another thing they're doing these days. When I remember during the anti-war movement and civil rights movements in the 60s, they would beat the living crap out of people. They would lock people up, and they would ruin people's lives if they could. But this is they never went after the press. And the only time they ever did was in Chicago in 1968, and that was a turning point. Now, when there's an Occupy movement, when there's a demonstration, the press gets either beat up or locked up, and yet the rest of the press doesn't do a damn thing about it. So this is what we've come to. Other people who were arrested, a member of the press and the group's attorney was arrested. Cameras, camcorders, and phones were confiscated by the sheriff's department, etc. So if we're lucky now, we do have Elliot Adams on, who is the past president of Veterans for Peace, and he's the current nonviolent training coordinator for Veterans for Peace. You there?
I am.
Oh, good. So I was just reading to people exactly what you were involved in up there. Maybe you could expand on this happened last Sunday?
It would have been last, I'm sorry, I've been through too many things since then.
A lot of stuff going on, yeah. But this past weekend, right?
Yes, it was. It was this past Sunday, that's correct.
Okay. And exactly what did, you've presented, now what were you trying to do at that Air Force base?
Well, first of all, let me give you a little background.
Yeah.
The Air Force base is being changed from a fighter wing to a drone air base. So they are going to fly them, maintain them, do everything there for the RQ-9 Reapers drones.
Mm-hmm.
And we know that they are flying them now in Afghanistan, so we know that they are involved in war crimes. And our obligation under the Nuremberg Principle is not only must we not commit war crimes, we must obstruct war crimes if they're taking place.
The average citizen is empowered by the Nuremberg Principles to exercise their rights to stop these crimes, right?
I would change that. When we talked to Ramsey Clark, he did not say we have a right to. He said we have an obligation to.
Mm.
And that's what happened in the third of the military tribunals in Nuremberg, where they tried judges for complying with the legal laws of the Nazi government, but those laws were a violation of the basic principles. And they found them guilty, and they gave some of them life sentences because they weren't complying with a local law, but because they were complying with the local law, and that they should have been able to tell the local law was in violation of the basic human principles.
Well, what if I say this to you? What if I say that, and there are figures here, I think, that your group released in terms of the number of people that have been, you know, estimated to been killed by drone strikes, and maybe it's like 3,000 or something like that or more. But what if I say, well, we need these drone strikes to protect our troops who are in danger over there and to kill enemies of the United States. What if I tell you that? What would you say?
Well, first of all, I'd say, don't forget, I was a soldier. I served in Vietnam, Japan, Korea, Alaska. I was in the infantry. I was a paratrooper. So I understand that argument. I would say it's very, very simple. Winning wars is about winning hearts and minds. That's what it comes down to, particularly when you talk about fourth generation war like we're doing in Afghanistan. And the fact of the matter is that drones lose hearts and minds and lose wars, and they make our soldiers much more vulnerable. But when I was in Gaza, I was with the Gazans there, and you could hear the drones overhead, and you could hear the terror in everybody's minds, knowing that at any moment that it might release a hellfire for right reasons or for wrong reasons or who knows why. But everybody was vulnerable at any given moment to be blown up. And the reality is, we know that in Gaza, we know that in Pakistan, we know that in Afghanistan, the drones make the average citizens, they make the normal, innocent citizens hate us, and you can't win a war that way. So I would say the drones make it more dangerous for soldiers.
All right, so, but also when I was reading these figures, you said approximately, according to these figures, approximately 20 or 25% of the people killed by drone strikes are innocent civilians. Correct? At least.
At least. I mean, I've heard numbers. There's been numbers that are much higher than that also. So one, you know, every weapon system has something that it's good at. So for example, aircraft carriers are very effective at making an air base way out in the middle of the ocean or next to somebody else's coast or somewhere something like that. Submarines are very effective at hiding intercontinental ballistic missiles and are effective at attacking warships from below. It turns out that the things that drones are good for is working way far behind the line of combat. Or the combat, out of the combat situations. And that means they are inherently prone to creating what we now call collateral damage, which incidentally are war crimes. Because we are not, we are obligated under international humanitarian law, Geneva Conventions and those, and that body of law, we are obligated to reduce the number of civilian casualties. So this is a weapon which is, very, very prone to creating illegal civilian casualties. Then the other thing which we have repeatedly used it for is assassinations.
Mm-hmm.
And assassinations are illegal under U.S. law and under international.
Not according to Attorney Holder.
Attorney Holder is a great illustration, just as, remember the judges who used to justify lynchings and used to justify denying the right to vote to blacks?
Mm-hmm.
The judges who did that, Holder is doing the same thing. He is distorting the law to serve his purposes.
So if someday the United States was hauled before an international court under the Nuremberg principles, Holder and the president and all these people would be held accountable, right?
Certainly. What would one of the main justices in the Nuremberg trial said? The laws that we are using to prosecute the Nazis are also going to apply to us, and we are going to have to live within them. And indeed, that is exactly what we're trying to do. Americans do not want our soldiers or our leaders or anybody committing what we would call war crimes. What are they? Torture. You know, torture is about only one thing. Torture is about sadism. When I was in the infantry, of course, they used to train us in the infantry because we were the ones who picked up prisoners. They told us, don't torture prisoners.
Mm-hmm.
Why? Not because of the Geneva Conventions, not because it was right, but because you destroyed the intelligence.
Mm-hmm.
So torture is not about getting into intelligence. Torture is purely about sadism. And we don't want our soldiers or our governments condoning torture. We don't want our soldiers or our governments participating in crimes against peace, which is starting illegal wars. You know, when the Geneva Conventions, when the UN Charter was created, it's an amazing document.
Mm.
And it's a critical document. It's a document that says we who sign this have given away to the group our right to create war because we understand that this is a way we can stop war. And it was an effort to try to end war after the horrors of World War II.
Well, it seems to essentially have been a failed effort, which is not to say that we should give up. But if you look at the whole history
it's not a failed effort.
Right.
Because we don't see the wars that were avoided. Is it perfect? Far from it.
Mm-hmm.
But it's amazing. You know, if nothing else, I can remember being at the NGO conference at the UN and sitting there in the General Assembly of Rome, and we were able, for example, a representative from the Pacific was there speaking in his own tongue, and all of us in the group could hear what he was saying simultaneously, could ask him questions, and could get answered questions. If nothing else, just that mechanism by which they can have resident translators,
mm-hmm.
Is a stunning piece of bringing humanity together.
Well, obviously, if people spoke with each other, and this goes inside a family and a relationship and between nations, right? If people spoke to each other, there would be 90% fewer wars, which is one reason why a lot of governments, specifically our government we're talking about, which is a corporate-owned government of the defense industry, among other industries, does not want us, our government, to talk to other governments. I mean, this huge push not to negotiate with Iran is irresponsible to the point of war crime.
That's correct. That's correct. Or a crime against peace. And certainly the rationale behind, to be even more cynical, the rationale behind this, what is it, it's a 10-year effort to start a war with Iran, the rationale behind it goes directly back to PNAC, Project of New American Century. They're the ones that said we needed to invade Iran, and there's been a continuous effort since then to drum up enough public support so they can attack Iran. And if you remember, after we attacked Iraq, the thing which sort of got the American people behind attacking Iraq or sort of supporting it mildly was when they said, well, we don't want to discover that they have a nuclear weapon by a mushroom cloud over Europe.
Which, yeah, sure.
Absurd concept. But, you know, one of those early morning times, you know, Wolfowitz had this terrible process of actually telling the truth. And one of the mornings they had radio stations, they had them out there, and the commentator said, well, why did you choose nuclear weapons? We knew they didn't have nuclear weapons. And he said, because our study group said that would work.
Well, I mean, he doesn't, he's not in the PR business as much as some of these other people. Let me ask you something. For Veterans for Peace, and Leah Bolger was on here, you know, a couple of weeks ago, are you a complete pacifist? Would you call yourself a complete pacifist? Was there ever a war that the United States was involved in, and obviously I'm thinking of only one that I can think of, that was justified and even legal?
I'm not a pacifist, and I don't think that, let me put it this way. I spent a period of time when I was, for example, I became a mediator for the New York State Office of Court Administration, and several of the people in our local peace group did that. And we did that believing that if we could figure out how you mediated problems between neighbors, then you could figure out how you could mediate problems between nations.
Makes sense, yeah.
Yes, except there's one problem. And then there's people who say, well, the war is an extension of the incapacity of the human beings to get along or to negotiate problems.
Mm-hmm.
Or that Americans as individuals are too warlike, and that's what supports the war. But I think that there's one piece we forget. And that is, there's this amazing disconnect, because every single war we have been in, they have lied, they've cheated, they've connived to convince us to go to war. And if they had to do that to us, if they had to trick us into going to war, it proves it's not a fallacy on our part. Because if it were a fallacy on our part, they could tell us the truth when we'd go to war.
If you were 18 or 19 or 20 during World War, in the beginning of World War II, after Pearl Harbor, would you have joined the army? Would you have wanted to fight?
Dave, let's not even go there. Back in the 60s, when Vietnam was going on, I walked down to the recruiter station. I volunteered for the Army. I volunteered to be a paratrooper. I volunteered to go to Vietnam.
And you did that. And you did that why?
I did that. Well, it's hard to say what I, why did I do it? Really, I did it because of 18 or 16 years of culturalization.
Mm-hmm.
But I did it because I believed, you know, I believed all those things which I now recognize to be false. I believed that a strong army guaranteed peace. I believed that my parents had done their role to, in the previous war, my parents and grandparents had done their role
right.
in the previous war to defend, to create to defend the freedom of speech.
Mm-hmm.
I believe that that notion, which is freedom is not free, which is absolutely true, but somehow bound in there is the idea that soldiers defend our freedoms. And I now understand that soldiers defend governments and governments take our freedoms away. And incidentally, I just want to pause that. If people want to question whether the government takes our freedom away, they have to be the one who takes them away, because if there are rights, then they belong to us until they're taken away.
You know, I think you probably are roughly of an age, you know, that I am, and we were brought up in the 50s just idolizing the soldiers who fought in World War II and thinking about the war as the great patriotic American war, the war to defend democracy. And, you know, this is how we were all brought up. If anybody wonders why it is that a lot of people supported the war in Vietnam, and it's what you're saying. Elliot Adams is our guest. He's the former president of Veterans for Peace. We were brought up that way. But I think people knew better after Vietnam, which is why they had their stroke of evil genius and had a volunteer army.
Well, they had the volunteer army. They came up with the nuclear threat and the weapons of mass destruction threat. They came up. The reasons for going to Iraq were purely economic. They're laid out in the PNAC document. That document tells the complicity behind it. If you recall, that's the document in which they said, we don't know how we're going to get the American people to let us do these invasions. It may take a new Pearl Harbor. Because they understood what they were doing was a violation of what people believed in and wanted.
And then we had our new Pearl Harbor on September 11th, right?
Yeah, that's correct. That's correct.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm just losing my train of thought.
Well, basically, the essential thing is here that you're taking action, and other people, obviously, you're encouraging other people to take action. But it seems like most Americans, I mean, you get people, how many people were in the group that approached the Air Force Base? By the way, they arrested you before you did anything wrong, right?
We were walking down the street. We were walking single file down the side of the road silently.
Mm-hmm.
And this is something we've done many times before.
And you didn't enter the base or touch
we weren't even near the base yet.
So now in America, you get arrested for appearing to be somebody who might commit a crime, right?
Yes, and what I would say happened. So clearly, there's a couple of things I want to just talk about.
Well, I have to tell you that we only got, you know, the time goes fast. We only got about 2 minutes tops. So.
Yep. So the law, there's a couple of principles here. The U.S. Constitution, First Amendment, gives us a couple of things, the right to free speech, but it also gives us a right to petition our government for redress of wrongs. And since the Nuremberg trial, Nuremberg principles and the UN Charter require that we try to stop our government from committing war crimes, then the simple right to petition our government to stop these crimes is inherent basic constitutional First Amendment rights. This was a preemptive arrest, which is wrong. You shouldn't have preemptive arrests. A preemptive arrest to try to stop us from exercising our First Amendment rights,
mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
and our Nuremberg obligations.
We have only 1 minute left. Enough time for our guest, Elliot Adams, is who you're listening to, a former president of Veterans for Peace. Since we only got a few seconds left, maybe you could tell people where they can go to get more information about Veterans for Peace.
The best place to go is to our website, which is veteransforpeace.org. And we'd love to have you there. Our work is to support the work of other people who are trying to stop war, generate peace, bring our world to a more sane level.
Okay, and I guess I would throw in also one of the best places to go to for this kind of thing is warisnotacrime.org. With David Swanson. Yeah. Elliot, thanks a lot for coming on. I really appreciate it. And
thank you for your work and having me on and your work helping people get access to good information.
Yeah, I guess I'm not going to be doing my marching days are over, but at least I can have people like you on, so I want to keep doing that. Thanks a lot. And keep me abreast of what goes on, all right?
Great. Great. And okay. We all have our role.
Okay, thank you very much. Thank you.
Thanks.
Okay, we'll be back next week with some more guests. Bradley Manning's trial is continuing this week, and even as we speak, it's continuing. There are all kinds of motions and arguments being made, and we're going to go over that with a guest next Thursday at the top of the hour about what happened with Bradley Manning's continuing trial. This is Mike Fader, Occupied Territory. Make sure to go to our Facebook page, check out our archives, and thank you very much for tuning in.